gentlemen, if I can call this meeting to order. I'm your chairman tonight. I'm Neville Archibald, and I'm from Wyuna. This is the second meeting, or the second speakers forum of the Murray Electors Association for this year. Tonight we have Professor Samuel Blumenfeld, who is to speak on education. So if you can leave your questions until the very end of the speech and address them to myself, I shall repeat them for the benefit of the tape, and Professor Blumenfeld will answer it.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here in Shepparton, to be in Australia in general. This is my first visit to Australia, and you have a beautiful, large country. And, of course, for Americans, Australia is legendary. You know, everyone dreams of going to Australia to, I suppose, for adventure or whatever, or to meet up with a kangaroo, one or the other. But I'm the envy of all my friends in the fact that I've been able to travel down under here to this marvelous country. And, of course, I was asked to come to Australia because of the concern of many Australians for the education of their own children. Apparently what is happening here is very similar to what's happened in the United States. As a matter of fact, during the last few weeks, I've been here since the 1st of August, and I have visited schools, I've talked to parents, I've talked to teachers, and I can say without any doubt that the educational philosophy of the government schools in Australia is exactly the same as the philosophy of the government schools in the United States, and I might add also of Canada and the UK. Apparently the four major English-speaking countries are under the control of the same socialists and Fabians as they are here. You have a socialist government. We have a supposedly non-socialist government, but increasingly our education department certainly is controlled by socialists, and it has been so for many years. And so we're seeing the same things done, the same illiteracy, the same downgrading of the academics in favor of socialization. As a matter of fact, in one of your schools here, one of the junior primary schools, the teacher told me that the goal of the system was to promote socialization, and that academics were taught incidentally, you see, incidentally. And when you teach the academics incidentally, you get a lot of young people who are not very keen on reading or writing or into geography or history. And of course, if you don't know the history of your own country, if you can't read, then you're susceptible to being manipulated by the political forces above. To give you an idea of how serious the problem is in the United States, though, let me just show you some cuttings from our newspapers, which illustrate what is happening there. Here's an article, 3.1 million in California functionally illiterate. 3.1 million in California functionally illiterate. These are people who might be able to read a simple sentence but can't tell whether a lease they signed with their landlord is taking them to the cleaners. Almost one in six adults in California is functionally illiterate, and most of those who can't read are native English speakers who went to school in the United States, according to a new study by the State Department of Education. So that's the official estimate. One in six adults in California, and they all went to American schools. So you can actually go to school in America and come out functionally illiterate. Now, here, that's the Pacific Coast. Here's the East Coast, New York State. Senate commission, New York State Senate commission. See, our states have legislatures just as your states have them. The commission placed the number of functionally illiterate adults in New York at 2.8 million and said that number will increase by 15% to about 3.3 million by 1992 if nothing is done. Now think of that. If nothing is done. What do they mean by nothing? First of all, they're already forced to go to school. We have compulsory school attendance, so that's certainly more than nothing, but to them it's nothing. We have trained teachers. They've all gone to college, they're all certified, they've all got their credentials. They're doing the teaching, and that supposedly is nothing. So what more is there to do? They don't tell us what, you know, if nothing is done, what more can you do but that so-called nothing which is already being done? They don't tell us. Of course, the inference is that more money will solve the problem. That's always what the teachers' unions tell us. Just give us more money and we'll solve the problem. Of course, we've been giving them more money every year for as long as we can remember, and things get worse. Here's an article that was in U.S. News and World Report in 1987, The Brain Battle. Students in the U.S. now enter the job market with inferior skills. Once the unquestioned champion in industrial research, America is watching its lead dwindle. Some experts go so far as to suggest that failings in education put the nation in danger of becoming a second-class economic power. Now, this was 1987, so that's already 4 years old, and I can assure you nothing has been done. Corporations forced to teach the basics. That is, these children come out of our, the young adults come out of our schools totally inadequate in skills, and so now corporations actually have courses to teach young adults reading, writing, and arithmetic. Subjects which they should have mastered in the first and second grade. Here's an ad that was in one of our major publications, the New Yorker magazine. One of five adult Americans is unable to read this sentence, or a warning label, or a job application, or a love letter. You see, more than 27 million adult Americans are functionally illiterate, and the ranks are swelling by more than 2 million every year. Well, how do you get swelling ranks of functionally illiterate people who are going to school? They never bother to answer that question. Somehow, all they do is tell us that we have all these functional illiterates, but they don't say what is the cause of the problem. Here's another ad that was in one of our business magazines. Every day, 15% of America's workforce runs across 26 major obstacles. Do you know what the 26 major obstacles are? The letters of the alphabet. Since when have the letters of the alphabet become an obstacle? But they are to Americans, to 15%. Our business people are terribly alarmed. For example, the chairman of the Xerox Corporation, David Kearns, in 1987 said, he denounced the public schools as a failed monopoly producing workers with a 50% defect rate. Businesses must hire workers who can't read, write, or count, he said, then spend $25 billion a year to train them. There's another article, 1986, Nashville Banner. Study reveals staggering lack of high-level literacy in the U.S. There's another article from U.S. News and World Report, May 1987. The burgeoning educational underclass. Nationwide, nearly a million students graduate each year unable to read and write. And one in four never graduates at all, and the problem has been getting worse. So we actually graduate students who can't read and write. You could see that this is a totally phony educational system. How can an educational system, in any way say that they're doing a job by actually graduating people who can't read and write? And they manage to get away with it. And here we are, and you can actually spend 12 years in an American school and come out knowing nothing. And that's quite an achievement. We do it every day, though. It's one of the great wonders of the modern world, that you can spend 12 years in an American school and come out not knowing how to read or write or spell or add or think. And it's just wonderful. Here's a rather humiliating article. Americans finish last in international spelling bee. See, our children can't spell anymore because they're taught creative spelling. Have you heard of creative spelling? where you just, no, it's not creative, it's invented spelling. That's the new one, invented spelling, where children are told, well, you just write it any way you want, you know. We don't want to tell you how to spell anything because we're afraid that your self-esteem is so fragile that if we just, if we even so much as hint that you don't know what you're doing, you're liable to wind up in a puddle on the floor. So we're not gonna in any way tell you how to do anything. You just do it your way. Here's an article in Nation's Business. Can your workers read? You'd be surprised how many people manage to disguise their illiteracy in our workforce. As a matter of fact, I was in North Carolina visiting a friend, and a corporation there was going to install computers, and they wanted to find out whether their workers had computer abilities, and they tested them for their literacy, and they were just amazed at the number of people in their workforce who could not read. In other words, these people could handle the mechanics in a plant, in a factory, but when it came to dealing with computers, which required a higher level of literacy, totally unprepared for that kind of technical work. Here's another interesting article that was in Time magazine. Losing the War of Letters. A government study finds that one of eight Americans cannot read. We are creating a new generation of illiterates. Now, I don't know how you create illiterates. Usually an illiterate is somebody who never went to school and learned to read. I mean, you know, you don't create it. You don't create an illiterate. He gets off the boat from wherever it is, can't read. No creation involved, is there? But what they mean is that we create these functional illiterates. As I said, a simple illiterate is someone who never went to school, but a functional illiterate is someone who has spent from as many as 8 to 12 years in school and has come out at the end of the process with reading skills so deficient that for all practical purposes, that individual might as well be considered illiterate. You see, you have to go to school to become a functional illiterate. And that's what we now specialize in, producing functional illiterates. Newspaper editors are quite concerned because their newspaper circulation is not growing. Young people aren't reading newspapers. Do they read them in Australia? They don't read them in the USA, I can tell you. And he writes, this particular newspaper editor who was speaking to a International Circulation Managers Association, he said, if we can't stem the tide of illiteracy, our circulation base will continue to stagnate or shrink. But worse, illiteracy will do what no enemy has been able to accomplish, undermine the foundations and values of this country. And believe you me, that is exactly what is happening, because if these young people can't read their Constitution, can't read their Declaration of Independence, can't read their history books, can't read the Bible, where are they? They're just going to be totally dependent on the boob tube. That's what we call television, the boob tube. Do you use that term? Boob tube? Here's another article. Hundreds of job applicants can't read, write, or add. Well, you might ask, well, what is causing this problem? Why has it become a mystery? Well, you know, we know the cause of the problem. I've known it. Many Americans have known it for many years. We've known it at least since 1955, if not earlier. As a matter of fact, I'm going to read to you some lines from an article that was written in 1954. How many years ago is that, 1954? 36 years ago, 37 years ago, 1954. And what is the title of the article published in Collier's Weekly, which used to be one of our major weekly magazines like the Saturday Evening Post? Why don't they teach my child to read? 1954. And this is what the man writes. He says, the man next to me in the airport bus entering Pasco, Washington said, my six-year-old reads words at school and can't read the same words when I point them out at home in the newspaper. In school today, the children aren't taught to read. They're taught to memorize. A man in the seat ahead chimed in, everything is pictures. My youngster is in the sixth grade. He'll still come across a word like pasture, and he remembers a picture in his early reader and calls it meadow. Neither passenger knew I was making a national study of modern education. They volunteered their remarks, sharing something they were concerned and troubled about. Like them, thousands of other American parents with first-grade children who are not catching on to reading as taught by the modernists, and those with upper-grade children handicapped by lack of a solid reading foundation, are concerned and troubled. But most of all, they are puzzled. Why is reading being taught this way? 1,000 times one hears the question, why don't they teach my child to read? How can schools tolerate a method which turns out many children at 8, 9 and older who stare helplessly at a word, not on their memory list, and cannot make a stab at reading it? What has happened to the method of teaching reading sound by sound, syllable by syllable, so that a child can at least make a reasonable attempt at reading any word? Two basic teaching methods are in conflict here. One is the phonetic approach, known as phonics, the old-fashioned way in the view of modern educators. They are likely to call it the spit-and-spatter, or grunt-and-groan method, satirizing the way youngsters try to sound out letters and syllables. The other method, which the modernists have put into vogue, is the word memory plan, also known as sight reading, total word configuration, or word recognition. It has the more friendly nickname of look and say, since the youngster is supposed simply to look at a word and say it right out. He memorizes the shape of the word, the configuration, and identifies it with pictures in his workbook. Often he is taught to recognize phrases or whole sentences in his picture book or on flash poster cards before he can independently sound out and pronounce such simple words as cat or ball. The fundamental difference in approach in the two methods reaches deep into philosophy and scientific theory. Thinkers have wrangled for centuries over which comes first, the whole or its parts, an argument perhaps as endless as that over the priority of the chicken or the egg. The phonics advocates say the parts come first. The whole memory people say we start with the whole and the parts fall into place in due course. That was written in 1954, and it exactly describes what the problem is. Now, in the following year, there appeared a book which became a bestseller in America, Why Johnny Can't Read, by Dr. Rudolf Flesch. Perhaps some of you have heard of that book. But it became a national bestseller. Do you have a copy of it there? Oh, Why Johnny Still Can't Read. Well, that, he brought that out in 81. But in 1955, Dr. Flesch explained to the American people that the reason why Johnny couldn't read was because they weren't teaching him to read correctly. He said that he explained how the professors of education had thrown out the alphabetic phonics method in the early 1930s, and they put in this look, say, whole word, or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese, an ideographic writing system. And he said that when you impose an ideographic teaching technique on an alphabetic writing system, you get reading disability. Well, what he said was true then, and it certainly is true today. In fact, in 1981, Dr. Flesch wrote another book entitled Why Johnny Still Can't Read, because he realized that even though he pointed out what the cause of the problem was, the educators would not be moved. The educators insisted on teaching reading in that faulty way, and the result is that we still have a reading problem. Well, you would think, however, that since the problem was identified back in 1954, and in fact it was identified even earlier, but we know for sure, we have the documentation, we can say without a shadow of a doubt, 1954, and then 1955. You would think that somewhere along the line, the government, which has been financing remedial education now for over 30 years to the tune of billions of dollars, would have stopped and perhaps called for an experiment, would have said, well, why don't we find out once and for all which method works best? Very easy to do. What you would do is have one school using intensive phonics, another school using whole word or sight word or whatever, And you would just see which works best, which is the better method of teaching. But they haven't done that. As a matter of fact, to give you an idea of where things stand today concerning this controversy or controversy. How do you say that? In controversy, all right. Here's an article from Education Week, March 21st, 1990, just last year. From a great debate to a full-scale war, dispute over teaching reading heats up. After 34 years, it's heating up. In 1967, one of the most prominent researchers in reading instruction, Jean S. Schall, analyzed the controversy that was then raging in the field in an influential book called The Great Debate. Today, nearly a quarter of a century later, the Harvard University scholar says the debate not only persists, but has in fact escalated to a full-scale war. The battle lines are drawn between advocates of phonics, who stress the importance of teaching the relationships between letters and sounds, and those of whole language methodology, who believe children should be taught reading by reading whole texts. It's always been in reading that there was restraint with all our fighting, Ms. Schall says. Now it's as if all restraints are gone, unquote. So now we're involved in a full-scale war. And what are the educators doing? They're still denouncing those of us who advocate intensive systematic phonics. And now they've come up with a new way to teach children to read. Really, it's just a revised version of this look-say method. It's now called whole language. And they tell us that it's a wonderful new method developed in Australia. And they're telling us that it's working wonders in Australia, and now we're going to use it in all the schools of America. So thank you, Australia. Well, perhaps you don't know what whole language is about. Not too many Australians do. But there was an article in our Washington Post, which is the major newspaper in our nation's capital. This is the newspaper all the senators and congressmen read, the president. And here was an article about whole language to explain what this wonderful new method that came all the way from Australia is about. It says, reading method lets pupils guess. Whole language approach riles advocates of phonics. American Reading Council President Julia Palmer, an advocate of the approach, said it is acceptable if a young child reads the word house for home or substitutes the word pony for horse. It's not very serious because she understands the meaning, said Palmer. Accuracy is not the name of the game. So that's what whole language is. Accuracy is not the name of the game. Oh, yes, accuracy is for the Japanese, but certainly not for us. It's only for slanty-eyed people, you know. Accuracy is not the name of the game. Reading method lets pupils guess. And so if the child sees the word horse and says pony, that's okay. Nothing to worry about. But you can see that child hasn't even learned the alphabet. That's why those 26 letters are obstacles, have become obstacles, because they're teaching children to look at these words as little pictures. And I can tell you right now, they're doing it here in Australia. Because when I was in Adelaide, my hostess arranged for me to meet the head of the curriculum development department for the primary schools, junior primary schools, and we sat there arguing over why it's not good for children who see the word horse to say pony, and they insisted that it was great. These are your educators. Of course, that's South Australia. I imagine that Victoria is not much different. Imagine they're using the same method there. So these poor little children are going to be just as crippled by their reading programs as our children are in the United States. Now the numbers are skyrocketing. And of course, what has happened is that these children who are taught by this new whole language method, as I said, it's not really new. The only thing that's new about it is that they've discarded the the Basil reading, these insipid little stories. You remember Dick and Dora? We have Dick and Jane. You've got Dick and Dora. We have the dog's name is Spot. Yours is Nip. Our cat is Puff. Yours is Fluff. Big difference, right? Same methodology, producing the same results. So our educators know that the method doesn't work because the tests show it they don't work. As a matter of fact, the youngsters are having such problems reading that the educators have become alarmed that this might reflect on this new method. So what is their solution? Whole language advocate says new tests are needed. If students taught to read by the new whole language methods don't do well in reading tests, the fault is with the tests, not the teaching methods. Dr. Marie Carbo, a leading whole language teacher, told the New England Reading Association Saturday in Portland. Are these people crazy? Don't you think there's a kind of strange kind of insanity that has hit these people where they can actually say that there's something wrong with the test, you know? That if a child sees the word horse and says pony, it's all right. I suppose it's all right if he says sees the word horse and says Mustang, colt, foal, mare. And I suppose if the child sees the word arsenic and says aspirin, that's okay too, isn't it? You know, accuracy is not the name of the game, is it? But you can see what it does to the children. If they come out of school believing that accuracy is not the name of the game, and they hit the job market, and they find out that accuracy is the name of the game, then they think back and they say, why weren't we told that by our teachers? Why were we lied to? Why were we misguided? Why were we mistaught? Why were we miseducated? But by then, the young people are so confused, they really don't know what's happened to them. But you know, there are many youngsters who realize that the schools are doing terrible things to them. And that's why all across the United States, there's vandalism in the schools. Schools are broken into. Desks are overturned. Schools are set on fire. The children have come to hate the schools because they know the schools are doing something to their minds. The schools are destroying their intellect. You see, because these children came to school feeling very intelligent. As you know, every child teaches himself or herself to read all by himself. Without, you know, every child does that. And by the time they're ready to go to school, they've developed a speaking vocabulary in the thousands of words, so they feel very intelligent. And remember, these children have done it all by themselves. They're great self-teachers. They've done it without the help of Sesame Street, without the help of, you know, puppets jumping out of trash bins, and without the help of Mickey Mouse. So they feel very intelligent when they enter the school, and yet within 6 months they begin to feel stupid because they can't learn to read. And they say, gee, I thought I was intelligent. Something is happening to me. Now, they still feel that they are intelligent, but they know that something is being done to them. And that's when they begin to realize that something terrible and harmful is being done to them. And when you begin to have that kind of a feeling about your school, you're not going to have the kind of love and affection and respect that I had when I was going to school back in the 1930s, when they indeed taught us to read and to write and to do arithmetic. So when I was going to school, we had nothing but admiration and affection and love for our teachers. And of course, our teachers kept their respectful distance from the students. In those days, you sat in rows of desks bolted to the floor, and the teacher sat in front, and the whole class paid their attention to the teacher. And you learned. You felt you had a direct relationship to the teacher. Today, there are no more rows. The kids are seated around little tables, or they're on the floor, or on bean bags, or under the table, and the teacher has become a facilitator. She just walks around and checks to make sure that everybody is doing something. Or in some classes, the kids are crawling all over the teacher. It's now the touchy-feely type of classroom where the kids are on the teacher's lap. They're all over the place. And totally different situation. And now the teachers want to know all about the students' feelings and their beliefs and what goes on in their families and how to, and who do they like best? Do they like their mother better than their father? Or what don't they like about their mothers? What don't they like about their fathers? They're prying into family life and getting into the emotions of the children. And I can assure you that back in 1931, the last thing my teacher wanted to know was how I felt. She just wanted to know whether I knew what she was teaching her. Well, so we have an entirely different kind of education system. Why do we have that kind of system? Because the people who control the education system want to change this country, and they want to change the United States. You know very well that your leaders, your educators, want to change this into a socialist country. All I have to do is quote from Bob Hawke's speech that he gave to the Fabian Society on their 100th anniversary in May 1984. He states very clearly, we're using the gradual method to change Australia, permanently change Australia into a socialist state. And he even quotes the person after whom the Fabian Society was named, Fabius Maximus, the Roman general who waited. And he says here, it is by our own sense of continuity as a government, a movement, a party, a cause which provides us with the stability and strength to overcome the countless setbacks we have suffered, and equally in the days of triumph to live up to the motto set for itself by the Fabian Society 100 years ago. And this is the motto, quote, "For the right moment you must wait, as Fabius did, most patiently when warring against Hannibal, though many censured his delays. But when the time comes, you must strike hard, as Fabius did, or your waiting will be in vain and fruitless," unquote. Has the moment come yet when they are going to strike hard here in Australia? Apparently not. This, of course, was written he made this speech in 1984 before the total failure of socialism in the East Bloc. Maybe they're revising their thoughts. But throughout this whole speech, he talks about how they've implemented the Fabian plan to gradually bring about socialism in this country, as they have been doing in the United States. Now, mainly in the United States, it's being done. We don't have such blatantly open, overt socialists in power. We have Democrats. That is, they call themselves Democrats, who run our congresses and but the socialists run our education system. And they're using the same technique to destroy the capitalist, individualistic religious system. And to give you an idea of what your premier says, now here's Mrs. Joan Kerner, former Minister for Education, now Premier of Victoria. This is what she said in a Victorian Fabian Society pamphlet in 1984. She said, "If we are egalitarian in our intention, we have to reshape education so that it is part of the socialist struggle for equality, participation, and social change rather than an instrument of the capitalist system." Well, it's very clear. Your education system is being used to socialize Australia, to change this country into a socialist country. Our leaders are not quite as frank, because they know that in our country, socialism is a pretty dirty word now. And so they hide behind all kinds of terms that deceive the public. But the results are basically the same. And the reason why they want to produce a nation of illiterates, because it's much easier to manipulate and control people who have no control over their own destiny. You see, if you're illiterate, if you don't know what's going on, if you can't read your constitution, which incidentally, I was given a copy today, which actually says that Australia was founded, you know, under with God's blessings, under your Almighty God. Of course, your socialists want to strike that. We have that in our constitution also. And they'd like to get rid of that. This battle has been going on, this fierce struggle. In our country, we see it more as a struggle between the humanists and the Christians rather than the socialists and the Christians. In our country, we see it more as a cultural and religious struggle rather than as a political struggle, as your Fabian socialists have constructed it here. But it all adds up to the same thing. Many of the humanists are socialists, and they've been doing to our country what your socialists have been doing to yours. But to give you an idea of what their philosophy of education is, let me quote from one of Lenin's closest colleagues, Bukharin, who stated in 1919 the following, and I got this incidentally out of a book entitled Communist Eschatology by Dr. Francis Nigel Lee. Bukharin said, "In bourgeois society, the child is regarded as the property of its parents, if not wholly, at least to a major degree. When parents say, 'my daughter, my son,' the words do not simply imply the existence of a parental relationship. They also give expression to the parents' view that they have a right to educate their own children. From the socialist outlook, no such right exists. The individual human being does not belong to himself, but to society, to the human race. The individual can only live and thrive owing to the existence of society. The child, therefore, belongs to the society in which it lives and thanks to which it came into being. And this society is something wider than the society of its own parents. To society, likewise, belongs the primary and basic right of educating children. From this point of view, the parents claim to bring up their own children and thereby to impress upon the children's psychology their own limitations must not merely be rejected, but must be absolutely laughed out of court. Society may entrust the education of children to the parents, but it may refuse to do anything of the kind. And there is all the more reason why society should refuse to entrust education to the parents, seeing that the faculty of educating children is far more rarely encountered than the faculty of begetting them. Of 100 mothers, we shall perhaps find one or two who are competent educators. The future belongs to social education," unquote. Well, there you are. That's the philosophy of education of your state departments of education, of your state governments, of the National Education Association of the United States. They really believe that they own the children. Not only do they believe that they own the children, they believe that they own you. Isn't that what they say? Society owns you. The individual human being does not belong to himself, but to society, to the human race. Now, what is society? What is society? It's a fictional entity. You can't belong to society. There's no such thing as, there's no entity as society. Where is society? What they mean by society is the government, the bureaucrats. What they're saying is that the bureaucrats own you. The government owns you. Now, I will ask you this. Who pays for the government? You do, don't you? You pay their salaries, don't you? So if you pay their salaries, you are their employers. Is that not correct? Now, since when do the employees own the employers? Very interesting. But you see, by using the word society, they can confuse you. But let's be realistic about it. This country is still a representational democracy. That is, you do put these people in power by voting for them. The bureaucrats are supposed to serve you. And yet, instead of being public servants, they want to become public masters, masters of the public. See, that's where you have to be very careful in the words you use in semantics. Very interesting how the socialists always pull out these terms that have no meaning for anybody. Oh, yeah, society owns you. The only entity that owns anybody is God. God owns the children. God owns us. God owns each one of us. Society doesn't own anybody because there's no such entity as society. Society isn't even incorporated. Doesn't have as we do in the United States. So it doesn't exist, but yet that's the way the socialists think. Now, one of the interesting things that's happening in the United States is because so many parents are aware of the deficiencies of public education, are aware of what the schools are doing to the children, destroying their morals, destroying their religion, not teaching them to read, preventing them from becoming readers, crippling them intellectually, that thousands and thousands of parents are withdrawing their children from the public schools, putting them in private schools, church schools, or home educating them. As a matter of fact, homeschooling now is the fastest growing educational phenomenon in the United States. It is really taking off. Every state in the union now has a home education association. We have regional associations. We have local associations. The parents are doing very well. It's an incredibly beautiful movement because what it represents is a radical departure from established cultural and status norms. When parents decide to teach their children at home, they are doing something which has not been done for 150 years. You know, this whole business of public education, government-owned education, is rather new. It's only a development that arose out of this business of the nation state and the idea that the state is the supreme sovereign. And it came basically out of Germany and England, where the statists who rejected God's sovereignty decided to create the state as the sovereign, as the owner of everything. And of course that was a result of Hegel's philosophy, Hegel's statist philosophy, in which he said that the state was God walking on earth. Of course, Hegel did not believe in the Bible. He didn't believe in the God of the Old and New Testaments. He didn't believe in Jesus Christ. He was a pantheist. He believed that everything is God and that the universe is God perfecting himself. And this method of perfection is a dialectical method. And of course, Marx then adopted the dialectical technique. And then he adopted the socialist ideas of Robert Owen, the father of English socialism. And Marx then created revolutionary materialism, revolutionary communism, and dialectical materialism. Now, I've been given many cuttings about what is going on here in Australia. Here's one: college illiteracy alarming, tenfold rise in help needed, says officer. Queensland needed 10 times more literacy experts than were available to deal with the alarming number of college students with literacy problems, an adult literacy officer said yesterday. So, and incidentally, I've met many parents at my meetings who tell me these horror stories of their children not being able to read. I met an adult the other night who was practically illiterate. He had gone to schools in the Melbourne area. Falling standards, a scandal. Education crisis in Australia. The dramatic decline in the standard of Australian schools since World War II was scandalous, a senior academic said yesterday. The University of Wollongong Pro Vice Chancellor Professor Lachlan Chipman told an Australian Family Association lunch in Brisbane there was an enormous amount of evidence showing the decline. The education crisis would critically affect the Australian economy, and its international performance was a direct result of poor quality teacher training institutions. So you're getting the same thing that we have. I won't belabor the point. The point I want to make, though, is that there are solutions to the problems, but the solutions must now come from individual parents. The educators will not be moved. The politicians will not be moved. This is what we have found in the United States. And that is why the people of the United States are now taking matters into their own hands. Now, of course, the educators don't like this. They're surprised that all of a sudden parents are asserting their right to educate their children. Now, they believe that parents don't have that right. Bukharin said they'd be laughed out of court. And the educators have dragged parents to court. Some parents have actually been jailed. Some parents have actually had their children taken from them in very dramatic scenes where the police cars have driven up to the home and dragged the children out of the home. One case in Idaho, which made all of the newspapers. So they're trying to frighten the parents, but the parents will not be frightened. The parents are standing up for their rights because, you see, America is supposed to be a free country. But what we have found out, that's a great pretense. And what they've been trying to do is maintain the pretense that America is still a free country. But they can't maintain that pretense by going into homes and taking children away and locking up parents. Then it doesn't look too good. And people get upset and they say, hey, whatever happened to our freedom? As long as parents did not assert their rights, everybody assumed that they still had their freedoms. Little did they know that their freedoms had been abridged, that the educators no longer believe that those parents have that right to educate their children at home. And so now that parents have stood up, we have a royal battle going on in every single state of the American Union. Every single state, we've got battles going on between the educators and the parents. Parents being taken to court. All sorts of harassment going on. But yet the homeschooling associations are growing in strength and power. And eventually they will be able to stand up to the legislators, look them in the eye, and tell them, you'd better start counting. There are more parents than teachers in your constituency. And if you want to be reelected, you'd better start sticking up for our rights. I remember when I was in Alaska and visiting the state legislature, I was talking to one particular representative, and I asked him, what is your stand on parents' rights? Well, that totally threw him off. He didn't even know there was such a thing as parents' rights. He hadn't heard of parents' rights. And he said, well, what do you mean by parents' rights? I had to explain to him. Well, the right of a parent to educate their children at home. I suppose they have the right. They're not sure, you see. When you don't use your rights, they fall into disuse, like your arm. If you don't use your arm, it's going to shrivel up. You know what happens when your leg is in a cast for a couple of months? You then have to exercise it to get it back into shape. And that's what we're doing now. We're beginning to exercise basic rights. And we're beginning to tell the educators and the government that America is the land of the free and the brave. And don't you try to change that. And I think that that's what Australians have got to do. You've got a beautiful country. The very fact that I can stand here and speak tonight means that it's still a free country. But Mr. Hawkes and Mrs. Kerner have their plans. He's dying to see that moment when the Fabians can strike hard and put you all in jail for even being here tonight. I don't know if you heard the news this evening, but you know, Gorbachev is out. The hardliners are back in, and you can imagine how the people in Russia feel. They're going to now begin closing their doors and shutting up, because the reign of terror is soon going to begin. But you haven't reached that point yet, and you can prevent it. It's up to you. And it does not take many people to do it. Don't assume that you've got to convince everybody in Australia of what is right and what is wrong. Because it's always a small, well-informed minority that can prevent the worst from happening. And so that's the message I bring to you here in Australia, that the education system is being used by the socialists in this country to turn this country into a socialist, egalitarian dictatorship. Because that's the only way they can possibly maintain their system permanently. Because as Hawke says, he wants permanent change. Not just a temporary 2 years of socialism, 10 years of socialism. He says permanent. Of course, there's no such thing as... He doesn't realize nothing is permanent. So that can't even be permanent. But at least he can dream. The interesting thing about Bob Hawkes, of course, is that I picked up this little book the other day, As the Twig is Bent, and in it, Bob Hawke talks about his upbringing, his childhood. Do you know that he was brought up by a congregational minister, that he was a Christian youth worker? And I was amazed to read of how he became converted, how he became a socialist. This is how it happened. He said, "Within the church, I was very active in the youth organization and became president of the Young People's Association in the Church of Australia. I was very active in church affairs until I was in my early 20s. In fact, I was an Australian delegate to the World Conference of Christian Youth in South India at the end of 1952. I think that was the beginning of the end of my beliefs in organized religion. The conference was held in Kottayam in the state now known as Kerala. It was the state with the highest level of literacy in India, and this was because it had a greater penetration by the Christian church, both Catholic and Protestant, than any other state." Mind you, that state in India had the highest literacy rate because it was Christian. Then he goes on, he says, "One of the results of that was that the Communist Party was stronger there than anywhere else in India. I remember there was extraordinarily cheap communist literature at communist bookstalls in the area where we were. I couldn't help contrasting the blatant opulence of the church and the leaders of the church and the totally unrealistic price of Bibles and Christian literature with the fierce dedication and involvement of the communists. It didn't persuade me to communism, but I can remember one day there, the hierarchy of the church put on an enormous garden party in one of the big homes. There were delegates from all over the world, and there were impoverished people really looking over the fence at the people gorging themselves. On Christmas Eve, there was a party, again, put on in one of these big homes, and we sang carols and hymns. Two lines that stuck in my mind at the time we were singing were the lines, 'Christ to the world we bring, the world to Christ we bring.' It all seemed like so much irrelevant and hypocritical nonsense to me. I walked out of the party thinking about these things and went down into the streets where there were scores and scores of people just lying in the gutters asleep. I was sickened by the hypocrisy and irrelevance of it all, which is not perhaps an entirely rational way to begin one's disaffection, but it nevertheless operated that way with me." Isn't that interesting that simply because Christians were living better, eating well, that this was his, that he felt at that point that he had to give up his belief in God. It wasn't God's fault that the Christians were eating well, I mean, or acting in the way that they were, or having a party. You don't give up belief in God because of what some Christians may do you? Your faith has to be in God as your creator. Your faith has to be in your covenant with God, your personal covenant, not what other Christians are doing. If I came to Christ by looking at how other Christians act, I would have never come to Christ. And I was born Jewish. I came to Christ not because of what, as a matter of fact, most Christians, to my mind, are not very good believers. Most Christians to me are nominal Christians. I wasn't looking at other Christians. I was looking at my relationship to Jesus Christ. That's what counted. And here he uses the excuse that he didn't like what the Christians were doing in Kerala because they were eating too well. This is total hypocrisy. He's the hypocrite. Not only that, but you know, Bob Hawks never worked a day in his life as a laborer, as a working man. He went to Oxford, he became a lawyer, and then he becomes head of Council of Trade Unions. What right does a man like this, who never worked a day in his life, you know, never shoveled dirt, never stood on an assembly line, to become the head to run the Council of Trade Unions? Another hypocritical act on his part. He's going to stand up for the working man. And then here he is, he criticizes Christians, but what about the socialists? You don't see him giving up socialism because of the way some socialists act. Oh, they've slaughtered a few million people, but, well, that's no reason to give up on socialism. That's the kind of man you have running your country. But another very important thing is this. Why is it that the Christian world lives differently from the rest of the world? Why is it that when I come to Australia, you have cars and highways and beautiful buildings, skyscrapers, and you can drink the water, not all the water, but most of the water. You can eat the food. You have a high level of everything, high standard of living. You go to England, it's the same thing. You go to the United States, Canada. Why is it that Christians have this incredible standard of living? You know why? Because the Bible tells man to take dominion over the earth and to create it, to make it into a garden so that it's livable, you see. So you've taken this continent, which was wild, and you've turned it into a garden because that's what God told you to do. But now, if you're one of the pagans in India, where you believe that you're a victim of fate, but the cows can roam around, and that you have no control over your fate, there's nothing that you can do about it but just lie in the gutter and starve, that's what their religion has done for them. You know, in Indian temples, the rats have free reign. The rats can go anywhere they want. Snakes, rats, they don't touch them. That's the way they live. You go to any pagan culture, go to all of Africa. You see, religion does have an effect on how people live their lives and what they do. We don't believe in being victims. We don't believe in being, you know, the victims of fate. Because we have a covenant with God who has told us to take dominion over this world and to make it into the garden, into a garden, to make our lives livable. Totally different form of philosophy. The communists took over the Soviet Union. What have they made of that country? They've impoverished everybody. Total impoverishment. And that's the kind of system that Mr. Hawks and the Fabians would like to bring here. Oh, they were praising Stalin's Russia. They were the ones who were singing hosannas to communism all during the period when people were being slaughtered by the millions, the Fabian socialists. And Hawks finds no fault with those liars who knew what was going on in the Soviet Union but wrote articles in the newspapers to deceive the people. That's what we're up against, that kind of deception. We've got to realize that Christians don't have what they have because they've stolen it from the third world. Christians have what they have because they've known how to make a garden out of nothing. And that's the difference. So we have problems. We've got, as I said, the solutions are going to be individual ones. You still have the freedom to educate your children in the manner that you want them to be educated. And you should exercise that freedom. And wherever, incidentally, there was a couple who were prosecuted in Melbourne, and they won. The court ruled in their favor. So the educators have not been able to claim that they own the children. I don't think they could get away with that, even in Australia. I think parents would stand up. I think people would resist. So that's my message. Don't wait for the government to do it. You do what you have to do and inform others at the same time. So now I will end my remarks, and if you'd like to ask questions, I'd be very glad to take them. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Any questions? United States defended the rights of any parents, or have the individual states of America defended the rights of parents?
Well, the no case has reached the Supreme Court yet, so we haven't had that any decision from the Supreme Court concerning homeschooling. Various courts have ruled different ways. Local courts have ruled against homeschoolers. Then it's overturned by a higher court. It's a very mixed picture. We don't have any really set precedents that have, cases have been litigated by homeschoolers claiming that the compulsory school attendance laws are vague. And many courts have ruled that that's true, that the laws are vague and therefore unconstitutional. Well, what's happened is then the educators go back to the legislature and they say, well, make it unvague, and make the restrictions, real, which is what is being done in some states. So you have this constant battle going back and forth. Many of our judges are humanists. Many of our judges are Christians. In a country where you have two moral codes trying to live side by side, you have a sort of judicial chaos. You don't know what you're going to get. You have some judges who believe that the unborn have no rights. Then there are some judges who claim, well, the unborn do have some rights. For example, if an unborn child is killed in an automobile accident, that mother can claim damages. But if she herself kills the child in an abortuary, oh, that's all right. I mean, it's so contradictory. But that's what's happened in the United States when you have a judiciary system that's been corrupted and perverted by these very unchristian and unchristian ideas. You cannot have a nation's laws based on two conflicting sets of standards or two different moral codes. Either thou shalt not kill. You can't have thou shalt not kill and thou shalt kill. You can't have both, one or the other. But that's our problem, and over the ensuing years, I believe that eventually we will win.
The question was, is there a short, quick answer to those people who wish to know more about homeschooling as to whether they will come out more perfect than perfect? That's close?
Yes, the whole question of socialization is constantly raised by the educators because to them, the goal of education is socialization. That is turning children into socialists. That's what they mean by socialization. And I saw it, as a matter of fact, in Adelaide in a primary school, a junior primary school, where I saw the children being encouraged to socialize, interaction, you see, with their peers. Now, the homeschooling children are the most sociable children you can find anywhere. This has been my experience. I've stayed in many homeschooling families, and I can tell you that these children, they relate to adults, to children. They're very social. And they have there's no lack of opportunities to, quote, socialize with people outside their family because they usually belong to churches, church groups, choruses, orchestras, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Little League. We have what are called Little League baseball, Little League sports. So there are plenty of opportunities. What they don't get is the negative socialization in the public schools, where the children meet the blasphemers, where they meet children who are sexually active, they meet children who are on drugs. In other words, these children are saved from negative socialization. Another interesting thing is that it is very unnatural to have children spend all that much time with others of their own age, because you don't go through life that way. I mean, are you always with people your own age, 6 hours a day? No, you're with a wide variety of people, and you've got to be able to socialize with a wide variety of people. Another important thing that takes place in the homeschool family is that there's more socialization among the children. The typical family today that sends its children to state schools has a disintegrated kind of family, because they will generally send, the older child will develop his friends in the high school, the younger child will develop friends in the primary school, and so their socialization is outside the family, and the two brothers or sisters really will never get to know one another very well. The older one will then get married, and all they know what they have in common are their parents. And they get together once in a while at holidays and weddings. But you'd be surprised at the wonderful friendships that children develop when they are being homeschooled, friendships that they develop with their own brothers and sisters. And that's a wonderful development. It's very good to get to know your own brothers and sisters well. Because remember, as you go through life, who do you rely on most? Not on your friends, but on your relatives. That's the way it's always been. As a matter of fact, if you look back in your own school careers, how many friends do you still have among those you went to primary school with or elementary school with? Now, maybe in a small town you may have more than people do in large cities, but there are very few that survive beyond that period that we've known them in schools. And who are the people that you wind up with when you're old and gray? It's either your sister or your brother or something like that. That's what it usually amounts to. So the family is really the primary social unit in society. And the family is really the unit that creates the fabric, the strong fabric of the society. So you want strong families. And homeschooling provides strong families. Now, as far as a short way of showing the benefits how well socialized youngsters are taught at home are, it's very easy for us to use the examples of our founding fathers, like George Washington John Hancock James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, all of our great men who were basically taught at home and who were extremely social human beings. I mean, after all, they were able to put together a revolution. They communicated with one another. They had very high literacy. They were strong individualists. And they were able to resist the mighty British Empire, you see, and create independence for our country. So, that's the example that we have, that prior to the introduction of mass public education, all people were socialized through their families. That was the main major way of socialization. And it was a healthful socialization, much more healthy than the kind of socialization we're getting today, where children are being influenced by the bad apples in the class. So I hope that answers the question. Do you want some further corroboration? Also, another thing, homeschoolers are very social. They have associations. They get together. And when they go to college, they have no problem integrating themselves with the college organization. They usually become the leaders of their class, and they're doing very well in our country. Is that the homeschoolers have standards, which are very important to have. Standards of behavior, and also a wider view of human beings rather than just their own little children. Incidentally, one of the major researchers behind whole language is an Australian professor by the name of Brian Camborne. Brian Camborne is now a professor at Wollongong. Now, I saw his name somewhere, and I said to myself, if I get a chance, I'm going to look up this guy, Brian Camborne, and see if he is actually the father of this whole language movement. He may very well be. Well, I happened to be in Townsville several weeks ago, And I went to the James Cook Library to do research there, and I asked the librarian, the lady in charge of the education department, I asked if she had any information on Brian Camborne. And she said, oh, well, Dr. Camborne took his PhD in this institution. So we have his dissertation here. Would you like to read his dissertation? I said, I'd be very happy to do so. So she brought it to me, and lo and behold, you know what his dissertation was on? He was trying to find in which way children best develop their language ability. Is it at home, on the playground, and in school? And what do you think Dr. Camborne discovered? That language of, development is achieved best in the home and worst in the school, in the classroom. So you know what he said? He said, well, this has great implications. We've got to change, we've got to make the classroom more like the home. So here he was practically telling us that homeschooling was the best way to develop a child's language ability. And yet he says, of course, at that time when he wrote that in the 70s, 1972, the homeschool movement wasn't even in existence in any great degree. So he said, well, we've got to change the, make the classroom more into a home type environment, which is what they've tried to do, but you can't do that. It just doesn't work that way because the classroom simply cannot be adapted to be like a home. So I'm going to see if I can visit Dr. Camborne when I'm up in New South Wales and perhaps ask him the question, did his dissertation vindicate what homeschoolers are now doing, and see what his answer is.
The question was, could you please describe values clarification more fully?
Well, now, values clarification is one of the means that the educators have used to undermine the Christian beliefs of the students by having them clarify their values. And they use all sorts of techniques, the lifeboat survival game, the fallout shelter survival game, in which the children have to decide who is to live and who is to die, you know. Who shall I throw out of the lifeboat? My grandmother or my sister, you see. This sort of thing, which is supposedly going to clarify the values, and what they say is that every child should develop his own value system, his own system of values. And the way he does that is to explore his beliefs and what he wants and what he feels. And of course, children haven't had the experience in life to be able to develop a value system. After all, the greatest philosophers in the world haven't been able to do it, let alone a little child, you know, in a classroom. But that method is being used to undermine the children's religious beliefs. For example, if a child comes from a home where abortion is a no-no, where they say that we don't believe in abortion, abortion should not be permitted, and if the child comes to the school with that belief, well, then they'll give the child an extreme situation. They'll say, well, supposing this woman is raped by a criminal monster and that there's every possibility that that child will be deformed and horrible and a terrible result, wouldn't you approve an abortion? Well, there the child will begin to think, you see, and they'll create this wedge. And then, of course, they'll make the situation a little less extreme until the child reaches the point where, with the pressure from the class and all the others, where he may probably he has what is called cognitive dissonance. The psychologists have invented this means of changing a child's belief by creating cognitive dissonance. What is cognitive dissonance? Conflict. Conflict in the mind over two moral codes. And then the child, in order to alleviate the conflict, will adopt one or the other. Now, some children will retain their strong Christian beliefs and maintain their belief that abortion is wrong. Other children, through various pressures, will decide, well, I'd better decide on the other side. So they alleviate this cognitive dissonance, and they go over to the other side, and then they become humanists or liberals or whatever that you want to call it, or little socialists or whatever. But that's how values clarification works in our country.
The question was, can you give us any idea as to how to counteract the the philosophy of feelings that is coming through in schools now? That's close.
Well, of course, if a person doesn't act on their feelings, then you don't know what their feelings are unless they're going to tell you. So the question is that individual going to act on his feelings? Now, in values clarification, they say that you must announce your views and you must live by them. And that's why, for example, in the United States, we now have this phenomenon, what they call gay pride. Have you heard of gay pride? We have parades in the United States. I think there was one in Sydney, as a matter of fact, because Fred Nile told me that they had a big picture of him, you know. But they're proud to be gay, you see. They're proud to be homosexual. They're proud to be perverts. And that has been brought about by this values clarification that says that when you make your decision, you have to be proud of that decision, and you have to announce it to the world. Because previous to that, there were homosexuals in America, but it was all very quiet, you know. It was all sub rosa, it was underground. They weren't parading in the streets. But now, every year, we have these so-called gay pride parades down, you know, in the major cities. And so it's acting out on the feelings that's important, you see. Now, of course, this business that is saying that it, if it doesn't hurt anyone, it's all right. Well, that's what they say about most people are tolerant of homosexuality, because they say, well, if they're doing it to themselves and it doesn't hurt anyone else, why worry about it? Why bother with it? Well, then what happens when you get a plague like AIDS, you see? You get a plague like AIDS, and suddenly some very tolerant person who is undergoing an operation, say in Denver, and gets a transfusion of blood given by a homosexual who has AIDS in Los Angeles, and he comes down with AIDS, well, it's no longer a matter of it not affecting other people. As a matter of fact, that's become a great problem in America, is that the blood banks, they're contaminated. Now they tell us, well, only 1 in 100,000 might get AIDS because of contaminated blood. But who wants to be the one? So now people are advised, if you're going into a hospital for surgery, plan ahead and store up your own blood for transfusions. Because so many people, and the interesting thing about this was that they only became aware of this blood contamination business because of the AIDS infections. Prior to that, many people in hospitals were coming down with hepatitis through blood transfusions, which were also coming from homosexuals, among whom hepatitis was very widespread. As a matter of fact, you remember the comedian Danny Kaye? He went into the hospital for a heart bypass, which was very successful. But he died of hepatitis because of contaminated blood. And we don't know how many people have died because of contaminated blood. And that blood was going through. Nobody worried about it. The hospitals didn't care. The doctors didn't care. The blood banks didn't care. But when it came to AIDS, people got a little alarmed. And so now the blood banks have had to clean up their act. And yet they're not perfect. The result, and of course we have this now, the AIDS. For example, recently, a man was killed in an accident. And a young man, and they immediately distributed his body parts to different people who were waiting for transplants, liver transplants, heart transplants, kidneys, you name it. And they found out that this person had AIDS. So these 11 people who got these body parts now all have AIDS. That's the kind of thing that's happened. But there's a case of a dentist in Florida who had AIDS and didn't tell his patients. And I think three or four of his patients have now come down with AIDS. He's dead now. But he has patients who are dying of AIDS. So there is no such thing as it not affecting others, so-called, if you have these feelings or if you want to, you know, do your thing and you're not bothering anyone. It has ramifications throughout societies. America, as a matter of fact, America is becoming an increasingly diseased society because of the high incidence of venereal disease among young people who are practicing premarital sex. I mean, we have diseases we never heard about before. Things like chlamydia and warts and some of the names of which I can't even pronounce. And the young people, the health of America's youth is declining because they are engaging in very unhealthy pursuits. Now we have our Surgeon General, Dr. Koop, came out with this booklet on AIDS to help people understand what AIDS was all about. And let me see if I have the issue that I wrote about that particular. Oh, here it is. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome. This was sent to every home in the United States, every postal box in the United States, and I did a little review of it. And I said, the word abstinence doesn't even appear in the pamphlet, while the word condom, singular and plural, appears about 19 times with detailed explanations about the condom's use. The main message of the pamphlet is that AIDS can be gotten only by engaging in risky behavior. Much of the advice is aimed at reducing the risks of risky behavior by using condoms and clean needles for intravenous drug users. Premarital sex is considered not immoral, but risky. The issue of morality is never raised for one obvious reason, the so-called separation of church and state, you see. And so Dr. Koop can wage a crusade against smoking as an unmitigated evil because of its health hazards, but he can't wage a similar crusade against premarital sex. Now, smoking may cause lung cancer, emphysema, and other bronchial problems, but premarital sex has already caused widespread venereal disease, AIDS, unwanted pregnancies, the killing of the unborn, unwed teenage motherhood, infants born with the diseases of their mothers, emotional and psychological traumas, the widespread use of birth control pills that are causing many symptoms of heart problems, etc. In other words, the health hazards of premarital sex are far more devastating than those associated with smoking. And Dr. Koop will take a stand on the latter, but not the former. Now, the pamphlet also says, you won't get AIDS from saliva, sweat, tears, urine, or a bowel movement. You won't get AIDS from a kiss. Now, that's a bald-faced lie. That's a bald-faced lie that you won't get it from a kiss. Because how is AIDS transmitted? It's blood. Now, you can't tell me that their mouths never bleed, that you don't have bleeding gums, or you don't have slight bruises. Say, for example, you've been sitting for 2 hours watching television and munching on Doritos. I don't know if you have Doritos in this country, but they can produce some pretty extensive damage to the roof of your mouth. And then you're engaging in deep kissing. Sure, that can go between two people. That's so simple. But that's what they're telling. And then they're saying children need not be told they can't get AIDS. No, children need to be told they can't get AIDS from everyday contact in the classroom, cafeteria, or bathrooms. They don't have to worry about getting AIDS even if one of their schoolmates is infected. This is what they're telling us. Now, here's a very interesting business, because even the much-heralded condom, as you know, is subject to failure. And the pamphlet states this. Condom use is safer with a lubricant. Check the list of ingredients on the back of the lubricant package to make sure the lubricant is water-based. Do not use petroleum-based jelly, cold cream, baby oil, or cooking shortening. These can weaken the condom and cause it to break, unquote. Now, can you imagine a functionally illiterate teenager high on alcohol or marijuana checking the list of ingredients on the lubricant package in the dark without a magnifying glass? You know how small these words are in these packages? Isn't that ridiculous? That's the kind of thing we're getting in the United States. Here's a full-page ad that was placed in a major New York newspaper by one of our major insurance companies. And it says, "Don't die of embarrassment. Yes, it could be embarrassing to ask a man to wear a condom, especially if you don't know him very well. But that's exactly who you need to ask, the man you don't know." That's the state of morality in the United States. And you can see our government isn't doing much. That's why the people are taking matters into their own hands. They're just sick and tired of listening to a government that lies to them, that is prejudiced, that has this big campaign again, no smoking, don't smoke, but then, premarital sex, that's fine. You can ruin the nation, you can ruin families, you can destroy lives, but don't smoke as long as you're not smoking, you see. That's the kind of thing that's happening.